Yesterday I introduced you to a friend of mine, James Carroll. I read a couple things by him, and today I have part of a poem by Jim. It's settling in time, it's prelude, it's poetry hour, it's getting you in the mood for today, or whatever you want to call it. And it's a series of new ways of seeing. It tries to pick up on what we said yesterday, and it gives you some illustrations in a new way of seeing things like learning and work and erotic love and religion. And so you listen to a parallel each time, and the second half is always a new way of seeing. Learning is no utility's hoard of packages of meaning, but rather what happens when you grow. Work is not the drudgery of wages, but how we build the world. Law is not the leveling of differences, but how we celebrate them. Leisure is not recovering from effort for the next one's sake, but contemplation for its own. Mind is not merely means to possession and power, but a way to stand under the world. Erotic love is no escape from fear, but man and woman fearful for each other. Family is not an isolated fortress, but the common gift to every life. Religion is not a trick played on God, but a language for speaking mystery. Friendship is not a device for promotion, but the company of failures. Solitude is not an interlude of presence, but the shadow of eternity. Freedom is not self-grandeur, but a chance for reckless service. Earth is not the road to other worlds, but the simple start of heaven. All week we're going to invite you into a new way of seeing, and I hope that begins to make some sense to you. I think perhaps poets do it as well as anyone I know. I once had a bumper sticker in the middle of the 60s that said, "Support your local poets," but somebody ripped it off. It wasn't the one that everybody else was having in the middle of the city at that time. If you haven't seen the other one, it's always "Support your local police." I would like to start, after that settling in or centering down or whatever poetry is for you, I would like to start today with a personal thanks for your welcome to us. Personal thanks for being back at Holden, for the spirit of Holden, and whatever part you play in that personally. I would also like to review just briefly. We're going to have 5 sessions. All of them have the same theme as the book, Things That Make for Peace. And I hope they hang together partly because I think the chapter Contemplative Vision is the key to the book. The one that we took yesterday was really prelude to a new way of seeing, and all of the rest of the week are concrete illustrations of how that might work out. What are some of the new areas of biblical consciousness, and what would they mean? Today it's theology of enough. Tomorrow it's simplicity of lifestyle. Friday it's nonviolence, or none of the options that the world thinks of when they think of conflict resolution. And Saturday it's global justice or world hunger. Yesterday, as we gave the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6:22, the eye is the lamp of the body, so if your eye is sound, your whole body will be full of light. That was this invitation into what Chardin calls the verb that really is all of life, the verb seeing. Clarence Jordan, in translating "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand," said it this way: "Change your whole way of thinking, for a new order of the spirit is impinging upon you." That's what we tried to say yesterday. Contemplative vision is not to see some different world, but to see this one differently. Now, as we move beyond that, today and tomorrow are one piece, and Mary and I have divided them. The theology of enough and the response to that theology in a simplification of lifestyle is one unit, but it really is a lot of material, so we have divided it, and today is more the theological basis, more the analysis of why that's an appropriate topic, especially this year or especially this decade. how the biblical consciousness or a new way of seeing lets us live with an understanding of enough is enough, and tomorrow is the more practical lifestyle responses to that. We've also divided it in that today is my turn for presentation and tomorrow's is Mary's turn for presentation. I guess you know most of us have lived in an era. I don't want to date anybody. I was born in 31, so I was born in a different era. But most of my life, there has been a way of seeing which said bigger is better. Most of the way of seeing of the people with whom I've lived have measured progress by whether or not there is growth and more. Most of the good news or bad news has to do with whether the GNP of the United States is up or down. So that I think if you talk biblically about another way of seeing, you have to realize that it is probably counter to much of the idea of what progress is and much of the idea of what success is in the United States. This has not been a biblical view of the good life, but I think we have been more conformed to the world around us than transformed by the renewing of the Spirit, even though St. Paul in Romans 12 told us to have the other way around. And I'm not sure our new way of seeing is because we have a new biblical interest among the churches. I think it's outward circumstances that have brought us to look again at our biblical roots. And maybe that's often the way it happens. For whatever reason, it isn't hard to get people's attention this year particularly when you start talking about living in a world of scarcity. I was in San Francisco. All you have to do there is mention water. In the midst of the tragedy of that situation, I still found some evidences of humor. The local newspaper wanted to give people guidelines for water conservation, and they didn't know how to say it. So the daily paper said, "You flush it only if it's number two, not number one." I guess that's understandable English without having to use certain words. But anyway, it's down to that kind of thing in San Francisco. You have people's attention if you talk about the fuel oil crisis in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and I guess some other parts. Those are the parts where we have the most friends and where our home is, and we hear the most about it. But this is a year when the idea that maybe we are coming to the point where we will have to learn to live within the limits instead of always fighting the limits is part of the daily headlines. And the reality about this world in which we live and the reality about some of the crises that face us have become common knowledge, or at least knowledgeable to people outside of the particular scientific sphere of geology or environmentalists. But quite recently, I think it's shocking that the kind of statistics and the kind of reality we heard about was so far down the path of crises proportion before it became public knowledge. But anyway, it's within the last, I would say, 5 years that it's been paperback books and articles in well-read magazines and newspapers. In fact, I think maybe the first article in 1972 called Blueprint for Survival was a prelude to the Club of Rome report, and for many of us, for the first time, we began to appropriate some of what our situation was. How many have read something about Club of Rome report? Can I just see the hands so I know if I'm talking into a lot of knowledge or little? All right? Little knowledge. I gave a plug for the bookstore yesterday or for the library. You can read the Club of Rome second report. It's called Mankind at the Turning Point. Meredith propped it up for you if you had trouble finding it. When I walked in this morning, it was propped up. Let me give you in a very brief way, and it has to be a superficial way because I'm not either a computer expert or a scientist, but they made a very readable book out of Mankind at the Turning Point. They use the technology of the computer, and they wrote computer scenarios, and several hundred scientists in a group called the Club of Rome tried to forecast what if, and then tried to read some of the predictions and some of the analysis of our present situation. They put into the computer the graph of world population growth. We knew some statistics, maybe you don't know them, I'll share them with you. It took from the beginning of time till 1830 until we had 1 billion people. From the beginning of time till 1830 to get the first billion. The next billion came in 100 years. And the third billion in about 30 years. And the fourth billion in about 15 years. And we could double that by the year 2020. In other words, we could have 8 billion just 200 years after we had the first billion. And if you put that into the computer and try to forecast what if there is no reduction in the population explosion and other things, it begins to tell you the kind of population that this very limited resource called the globe is going to support. That's one of the factors that went in. Food supply. Also putting into the computer what if the developing countries got the kind of technology we have, hybrid seeds, better fertilizers. What about the possibility of food from the sea? Then they put in the resources and how we're using them up. I don't know why tin is one of the first, but I think that's under 15 years, the known supply of tin. And everybody says, well, we'll find a substitute. But there are many, many more things on that list that we're using up, and when they're gone, they're gone. One of the shocking things was the oil, and then we felt it very shortly afterwards at the fist fights and even some shootings on the East Coast in the line for the gas indicated that that's really tampering with a way of life. I think they're getting at a real idol when the car and the Winnebagos or whatever else is part of your transportation system gets threatened. But the shock in the computer scenario was we have about 30 years of oil, 30 or 40. If they find 5 times the known quantities of oil, if they find 5 times what we think of now as our supply, it added 10 years to it. I mean, that was one of the times people began to understand what they were talking about. So we had the age of the images, the image of the farmer who had a pond and it had a kind of lily plant on it. And he knew that it covered the pond in 30 days, and it doubled every day, and the picture was he and his wife sitting there, not at all shook, on the 29th day because it was still half water. People tried to image the accelerating pace that some of these crises were coming to. The other image makers included people who said, after you read the Club of Rome report, the image you have is we are in a runaway car, on an incline, heading toward a steep cliff with a long drop, and our only hope is that the axle breaks before we get there. That the system as we know it will break down soon enough to save us from that calamity. Those kind of images do not bring much comfort. If they're clever, they're more fun to read. But however you read it, the Club of Rome talked about unprecedented, you can argue that if you wish, but unprecedented crises for mankind. The picture I had, the finish of the Club of Rome report, and I think John B. Taylor in the book that I'll talk about a little bit today has the same illustration. Amos has a picture in the Old Testament of a man who started down a path and met a bear. And being alert that day and a reasonable man, he didn't want to tangle with the bear, so he turned and took a different path, and he met a lion. So he kind of said, this isn't my day, and he went back home and leaned up against the wall, and a snake bit him. When you finished, you kind of had the feeling that wherever you turned, there was something blocking the path, and you had the sense either of panic or, where do I go from here? I gave a talk at Seattle about a year ago on the Club of Rome report, and I finished, it may have been a half an hour, and I gave some of the conclusions and some of the crises that they point to, not as hand-wringing despair or either as gloating people saying, ah, ha, ha, we've had it, but as an attempt to have us change. That's the whole point of it. But I did try to lay out what it said. A hand went up when I finished, and a voice said, obviously, you are a clergyman. And I knew I was in trouble. And everybody perked up. And they thought, now this guy's going to get it. We've got an expert here. And he continued, I am not a clergyman. I am a scientist. I've read the Club of Rome report. And very frankly, we can answer the things that they point to there. We can put our technology to work. And the points where they say we have crises, we can, in fact, and proved in the past that we can come up with solutions. people's discomfort level went down. It looked like there wouldn't be a very long evening of discussion, but he continued, "Unfortunately," he said, "so far all of our answers create heat. And scientifically speaking, there is no way for us to get rid of the heat we are creating with our answers to the problems that are confronting us. We're going to burn up." And he sat down. It was as though, having found that last path, there was something blocking that one too. We, needless to say, we had a little more discussion, and he was part of it. And again, not in a kind of hopeless, masochistic way, but again trying to come to deal with the reality of the world in which we live. Let me share with you the kinds of things that I think are now being said realistically, hopefully not in a self-glorifying way or trying to call attention to themselves, but realistically as an analysis of our situation. I'm going to read a very few sections of a 10-page paper. It was a speech at the Pachamateras Conference in Washington, D.C. a year ago. I'm going to tell you who's the speaker after I finish. "Thoughtful and informed people the world over are contemplating the future with an uneasiness that would have been unthinkable a few years ago. Growth and new opportunities have been the mode of life, nowhere more apparent than in the optimistic world of we United States citizens. That wave may now have crested. We may now be on a long slope down. We who fell heir to the new continent have tended to take our good fortune thoughtlessly, and with benign recklessness have depleted not only many of its resources, but now encroach heavily on all the resources of the globe. Half of the world population continues to live on small subsistence farms in an economy that has shown little, if any, change during the last 1,000 years. This peasant class has never known anything but hardship and never thought of the future without some modicum of fear. Strangely enough, that peasant life is a remarkably stable one. They have an enduring resilience in the face of adversity, and in all probability they are far better prepared for the future than we are. There was a hinge line, and it came sometime in the late 60s, and we mortals may be bound and limited, and that concept has even a greater force for us in the United States. The idea of unlimited and cheap resources was basic to our hopes and our social designs. Our public officials and our national goals are completely inconsistent with such a concept. Yet I believe that the constraints are not only growing in number, but they portend a very basic change in our way of life. It is a virtual certainty that we're moving from an age of affluence to one of austerity. Our economic philosophy of Lord Keynes, the major architect of capitalism as we've known it here, may no longer apply in our 20th century world in which economic growth may be limited. The giveaway, throwaway society is a thing of the past. We must finally live within our means or face complete social and financial collapse." Those are selected from that, but I think are the essence of the statement. The surprising thing to me when I heard it was who the speaker was, not that these things were being said. The speaker is Robert Anderson, chairman of Atlantic Richfield Oil Company. There have been people outside of the corporate structures who have not benefited from them, who have always thrown stones at the system, who have always been anti-corporate oil and Keynesian capitalism. But for a corporate oil executive whose life was in that and who personally benefited very much by that system, for him to begin to speak that way seems to me, for most people in the United States, we hear that differently. Maybe we shouldn't have heard it differently. If it was truth, it was truth. But I think when those kinds of people begin to say that, I think we listen in a different way. I don't know that it's the final proof, but I was surprised the other night. Howard K. Smith, in the little news spot on ABC at 6 o'clock, he started his editorial. He has about 2 minutes. You know, it's not really news, it's comment, commentary by Howard K. Smith. He started it by saying, "Now that the age of affluence is gone," and then he went on. Just kind of a statement of fact that I'm not sure would have been said a year ago. That the new Secretary of Agriculture, Robert Berglund, says that the world food supply and the population and our distribution system, that those things are a continuing crisis, and that some of those things are on a collision course. And for the president to say that the energy crisis is not a one-year thing, we're going to live with it for a long time. Those are the kinds of things that are now on the daily news. This, I think, brings a new consciousness to all of us. I sat in the home of a friend a little younger than I. His kids are, about 5 years younger than our kids. And he commented that his parents lived for the fact that their children might have a better home than the parents had, that their kids would go to college when the parents didn't. In other words, he can remember that his parents' reason for living much of the time seemed to be that the kids would be better off than they had been. And he said, now how do I begin to let my kids know that they may never have a house this nice? How do I begin to have the values in my children so that if we move into an age of scarcity, their life is not just shook and the rug pulled out from under them if we begin to live in a world of scarcity? I'm not sure there's a lot of parents thinking that way, but I think he's realistic. I mean, I think it's a time to think in terms of the values that we have and that our kids have. Coleman McCarthy in the Washington Post, before Christmas 2 years ago, had a beautiful column. I didn't cut it out, so I don't have it. I remember it. The title was Creative Deprivation of Your Children. And it really spelled out, right before Christmas, and the typical affluent U.S. Christmas, it spelled out your creativity this year ought to partly be aimed at depriving your children. If there have been philosophical, poetic descriptions that our way of life was not fulfilling, but by and large we didn't listen to that. Because of the last 2 days at Holden and hearing again about a book by Becker, I started it today, and there is a line in there, modern man is drinking and drugging himself out of awareness, or he spends his time shopping, and that's the same thing. That's laying it out there fairly straight. In Anchorage, a couple weeks ago, Mary and I visited with a philosophy professor, and as we started talking about consumerism in our society, he said that in the philosophical language, it's another form, clearly another form of hedonism, and that always came out of a kind of general despair. So there have been clues to the fact that our way of life is not as fulfilling as we thought or as we had been told. But I think until quite recently, we've not really seen that it was an anti-shalom, if you can remember some of the themes of shalom yesterday, or that it went against a biblical view and a biblical consciousness and a biblical way of seeing. So the rest of the time today, I want to simply invite you into that theology of enough and have that as a prelude for Mary for tomorrow when we try to make that very specific in lifestyle changes. I also want to recommend a book. Part of the thing that people do for me is read and recommend, because there's so many books, and if I have a good friend and trust him and he says, you got to read this one, that's usually the way I get books read. I recommend this very highly. It's called Enough is Enough. We've already told Meredith that if it's unavailable now, it will be available soon because Augsburg Publishing House, the ALC Publishing House in Minneapolis, is going to print an American or a U.S. edition. This is a very British book right now. The author is John V. Taylor, an Anglican bishop. And he wrote a pastoral letter 3 or 4 years ago to all of the clergy in his diocese. I have a copy of it. It was about 8 pages and mimeographed, the kind of thing that a bishop or a district president sends to clergy. But it was all on this idea of enough is enough, and the response was so positive. The students picked it up, and the Student Christian Movement, SCM in England, asked if he would expand that for a year's study for them, and because of that it became a book. It has a chapter summarizing the Club of Rome report. It has a chapter on environmental issues and says we're living like spoiled children, assuming there are nursemaids who always clean up after us, namely air and water, and that we really have been living like spoiled children. There's a chapter which I'll summarize today called A Theology of Enough. There's a chapter called The Cheerful Revolution, where he really just invites families and communities of people to be happy disaffiliates, to find your freedom in saying no to some of the pressures that come upon you. There's a chapter that helps you understand intermediate technology, which is the thing of E.F. Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful. Then there's a chapter on cells of dissent, and that's the most English because it gives groups in Britain who are living out alternative lifestyles. That's where Augsburg's supplementary 7 pages will give U.S. illustrations. Shakertown Pledge Group, Movement for a New Society. In other words, you can find out in the American edition a few more of the things about U.S. groups who are interested in simplification of lifestyle. But let me just give you some of the things that he weaves as a biblical way of seeing. Even if you start with the creation story in the Old Testament, that the very first sin was to fight the limits. There was one tree outside of all that God had created for man to use. And so instead of glorying in that which he had, the first sin was to want to go outside the limits and refuse to live within them. Or the Ten Commandments have that kind of theme of enough is enough. 6 days are enough to labor. And you have a day off. It's part of life to do your work and then to take a break. And I think I even said yesterday, Taylor makes a point when you get to Exodus 23. If you learned the Ten Commandments in a Lutheran catechism class, you probably were told to go to Exodus 20 and find them in the original, or find them as God gave them to his people. In Exodus 23, when they are repeated, the Sabbath day was also so that your oxen got a break and had a day off. And Taylor makes a point of our connectedness with even the animal life. In Deuteronomy, one of the laws is if you take the mother bird, you do not take the baby. And instead of that, we live a kind of lifestyle that hunts to extinction whole species of animals. That's contrary to the biblical view of enough is enough. Taylor points out that we've hunted to extinction 2 species of whale. And it wasn't even for our food. It went for corset stays, perfume, and pets. That we've done that kind of hunting, and it wasn't even that we were hungry. The whole idea in the Old Testament of gleaning, Mary and I in the last 3 years know a little bit about farming. We knew nothing about farming until 3 years ago. Sometimes I'm asked, what has it done for you to be in West Virginia for 3 years? My first answer is, we gave enough amusement to some mountain people who are far from paid amusement to last them a lifetime. And I really think that they thought, well, we can adopt at least one family that dumb and help them out. So that's the only reason we've survived. But anyway, we know a little about farming now. And the ads from John Deere and other corn picking equipment is, this will not leave a single ear. It'll reach across the road and get it if it falls in your neighbor's lot. You know, boom, boom. And that's so far from the idea in the Old Testament. Take it, but leave some. There's some poor folk counting on gleaning what you miss. There's just a different attitude. You never beat the olive branch twice, according to the Old Testament view of harvesting the olives. Some birds might need them and some poor folk might come along. You get that idea of enough is enough. Even in the idea of usury, I wonder if we'll come back to some of those things in these years of scarcity. There's an assumption in the Old Testament that if you have what you need and keep beyond what you really need, you're robbing it from somebody who doesn't have enough. And that's kind of a way of seeing which is very foreign to us. So that if you do have some extra, one of the things you could do is loan it to somebody who doesn't have enough. But it's out of bounds to charge interest on your being blessed and his being impoverished. And throughout a long history of the church, that was really held. Luther, church fathers, at one point, you laymen, lay persons, well, okay, but not clergy. That was in those years when priests and monks had a special call from God to live a kind of perfection that ordinary people were not called to do. Since you're part of the Reformation and the universal priesthood of all believers, all of that comes down as hard on you as it does on Paul and I and some others who can wear a backward collar once in a while. But that's been a discussion throughout the church. Or Jubilee year in the Old Testament. When the ALC was formed, in 1960, I think, yeah, 60. We all got in the mail a funny-looking plastic ram's horn. I tried to blow the darn thing. I tried for 2 days to pucker up and blow. I never got a squawk out of it, so we didn't use it at our church because I couldn't learn to blow it. But the idea was to declare at the merger of this new Lutheran church, to declare Jubilee year and to blow the ram's horn. Now, as I read back what that meant, they didn't mean that at all at church headquarters. They could never get away with declaring Jubilee year. You know what? Have you ever heard the four component parts in the Old Testament of Jubilee year? Jubilee was the 50th year, 7 times 7. You've done enough Bible study to know that 7 is a number that is a holy number. It's 7 days, and then you have a Sabbath on the 7th. And 7 years, you let the land lie fallow, but 7 times 7, or the 50th year, Jubilee. Four component parts. You let the land lay fallow again. You did that every 7 years, so you repeated it on the Jubilee. But there were three other things that didn't happen except for every 50th year. All debts were canceled. Anybody that had gone into debt during those 50 years, they were wiped clean. Try running that one up at your local savings and loan as a way to celebrate the bicentennial or something. All prisoners were released. Many times this was also an economic factor because it was usually debtor's prison. But it was just unconditional amnesty and pardon across the board. And all land that had been purchased reverted back to the previous owner. Try that one in America with the value we have on personal property. The assumptions of Jubilee were every once in a while you had to infuse the economic system with some levelings. You had to once in a while acknowledge that more and more, if you let it alone, power will come to fewer and fewer who will crush other people. So once in a while, you just spread it out again. When Jesus stood up for the first time in a public sermon in Luke 4, as you read back to that first sermon and wondered why he got in trouble, what he said there was, "I've come, this is the acceptable year of the Lord, proclaim liberty to the captives, let the oppressed go free." I think more and more biblical scholars would say he declared, "Jubilee is here, and I'm to bring it." And of course he was in trouble. From that time on, he was in trouble with those who understood that kind of liberation theology. Anyway, that's part of the Old Testament. Part of an idea of enough is enough. Every once in a while, just spread it out a little bit. Or the manna story. Maybe that's the best kind of paradigm or model for enough is enough. Do you remember some of the exact... I'm sure you remember the manna that fed the children of Israel, but there were two statements, both before as a kind of prescription and afterward as a kind of editorial summary of it. Let those who need more take more. And those who don't need as much, let them take less. Then at the end it said, in kind of looking back over it, those who took more did not have too much, and those who took less did not have too little. Only those who took more than enough, they were the ones in trouble, because theirs rotted and the stink rose to heaven. And Taylor says, that's what you see all around us. Whenever there's that kind of excess, that's not saying God doesn't supply our needs. It says when you're not satisfied with him supplying your needs and asking him to supply your greeds, you will always have what that manna story said did not happen in the children of Israel's case. That's the kind of thread that Taylor weaves through it. And the New Testament.
John?
Yes?
Is it Micah that talks about bringing in the full tithe and the overflowing blessing, you know, in the New Testament? That's some more than just enough. That speaks of an overflowing abundance.
Yes, and it's in the context of the kind of shalom community and the kind of blessing and the kind of generosity with what we have. In other words, Taylor is not talking about a new form of asceticism or a denial that God gives good gifts or that he bestows his blessings upon them. But in the Old Testament, there was that idea, I don't know if you were here yesterday or not, that shalom community was blessed, and partly the continued fact of there being a shalom community was when the responsibility of those who had been blessed were shared. I mean, I know Mary uses some of that language, including that shaking down, or running over, shake down, that God is generous in his gifts, And I think Taylor will give a good kind of summary of the fact that it's not poverty that God wills any of us to. In fact, it's a kind of abundance, but it's never that excess or greed. The kind of statements that he uses as his illustration of greed are going beyond that which I need or that which will bless me. Shame on the man who says, I will build a spacious house with airy roof chambers, set windows in it, panel it with cedar, paint it with vermilion. If your cedar is more splendid, does that prove you a king? Does that kind of conspicuous consumption make you something? Israel's watchmen are greedy dogs that can never have enough, Isaiah writes in the 56th chapter. Or in Proverbs, the thing that Taylor points to is voracious greed, and he tries to give the Greek or the Hebrew words that we simply don't catch the spirit of. The leech has two daughters. Give, says one, and give, says the other. Three things there are which will never be satisfied, four which never say enough: the grave and a barren womb, a land thirsty for water, and fire that never says enough. I think you have to hold in a kind of balance God's promises to bless his people, including abundant living, and whether or not that abundant living comes when you live within the limits and find out what's enough and live the kind of shalom community, or whether you misinterpret, according to Taylor anyway, that means a kind of excess for me, or a kind of voracious greed or insatiable appetites. I think he does a good job of bringing that in. But
the covenant was always understood as blessed to be a blessing.
Right. I guess that was a theme one year for our either Luther League or stewardship. That's a good biblical basis. In the New Testament, there are a couple places that he points to. Much of the Sermon on the Mount could be that. Therewith to be content, St. Paul saying something about contentment. Or he uses the word that we translate in the RSV, moderation. Let your moderation be known unto all men. I don't know what moderation means to you. It's not a favorite word of mine. I always thought we Lutherans were much too moderate. We needed no biblical injunction to tell us to be moderate, because we meant by that we were neither hot nor cold. And there is another passage in the Bible that says what happens to lukewarm water. But I really thought it was a kind of always in the middle of the road, not very risky. Taylor has an image of that word and that Greek word meaning fitting in or toning in. And if our witness to the world was to really fit in, ecologically fitting in, or as far as global justice and the needs of the world and our use of the world's resources, if we fit in better, it really would be a witness to the world and the kind of thing that perhaps is called for. What does this say for our responses? If the analysis more and more says that it's a very appropriate topic for the 70s to be talking about living in a world of scarcity. I'm invited to go to a Methodist conference in North Carolina that has already chosen what we had as our theme today for the next 4 years for their church's emphasis. That more and more people without any axe to grind are beginning to point to that reality. If it's an appropriate topic, if it concerns not only your kids but your lifestyle and our lifestyle, and if it's a very biblical thing to be talking about a theology of enough, even if that's a different way of seeing, what does that say? That's the topic for tomorrow. What kinds of lifestyles are appropriate if you find yourself in the affluent country but in the midst of a hungry world? I simply want to have as a final prelude to what Mary does tomorrow and to the discussion we have around that issue. I think it's more radical than the issues before us in the 60s. I simply want to say that as prelude. At first, it sounds kind of tame and naive compared to those exciting years of the 60s to be talking lifestyle. But I think what we're saying by that is that whereas in the 60s, at least here in the United States, the issue was like, is it okay if a black lives next door to you? Now, that's an oversimplification of the civil rights movement, but the question that confronted us was, is it okay if a black lives in your neighborhood? There was never an assumption that I still wouldn't be in my house, or in a similar house, or that the idea of a individual family with a house of their own with a yard around it was always going to be a style of life in America. I think in the 70s, the question is not whether a black can live next door to me, but will either of us have the kind of house we've had in the past? And really, that's a more radical question. Or in the 60s, is it okay with you if the poor folk get to live the way you live? And most Christians said yes. In fact, kind of charitably said, and I'll help them. The point is now, we can no longer continue to live the way we've been living. Mankind at the turning point says the world cannot afford another United States. And third and fourth world nations are saying, not very publicly because they're still too dependent upon us, but if you ever get to really know one, they're saying we can't afford even one. And they're saying that more loudly and clearly than we're hearing in the United States. The most profound speech on the floor of the United Nations, in my opinion, in the last decade, was a little fourth world country. Fourth world are those MSAs, most seriously affected. They can't even be called developing countries. There are even now fifth world nations, the ones without resources and landlocked. Most experts have just said, too bad if you live in Chad. There are some that are really outside of the possibility of survival. But anyway, a delegate from the fourth world nation, on a day the United Nations was glowing in the new detente, Russia and the United States were hugging one another, and the world was happy. I was glad for the messages coming from the UN. But this delegate had a very brief speech. I can teach it to you. It has two parts. The first part is, when two elephants fight, the grass suffers. That's the first half of the speech. Second half is, when two elephants make love, the grass still suffers. He sat down. That's all he did that day. I think more and more the reality of the world around us is that the thrust for global justice, not accidentally or incidentally, but primarily, is aimed at stopping us. And that's a hard reality to move into. And when Robert Anderson says voluntarily or involuntarily our lifestyles are going to be changed, I think it takes a lot of gospel, I think it takes a lot of faith, and I think it takes a biblical understanding of being pilgrim people with no continuing city. I've said all those things. I've sung, take they then my life, goods, fame, child, wife, when they their worst have done, they yet have nothing won, the kingdom ours remaineth. But I get shook if they tamper with the pension plan of the ALC. I mean, I've said big words about how strong my faith is, but I get just as shook as anybody else if we're going to be changed in some of the ways that look like they're happening. So I invite you, as we move into those times, that there is a biblical consciousness and a biblical way of seeing, and that I think you can celebrate the changes as God's action in history, and that maybe the task of the church is to choose some lifestyle changes prior to them being thrust upon us as one of the ways that we live out our faith. Almost that last part, I almost feel like ending with amen or taking up the offering. I'm sorry, I have my chance to preach Sunday night, but that's what happens when you bring a preacher in. We have a different supper schedule, and I know it starts at 5:15 and some of you have to leave at 5, but why don't we take some at least points of clarification or something, knowing that tomorrow is the more practical, is a response to today, is lifestyle changes, what does that mean, what are some alternative ways to live. So tomorrow really is discussion of today, but if you have either comments or questions or clarification points, let's spend 10 minutes or so doing it. Yes?
Would you go over the meanings and all the concepts involved in the word shalom again, please?
Okay, I tried yesterday to bring some basic themes out of some 350 ways that it's used. It's a very inclusive word in the Old Testament. It was a way to say hello, and it was a way to say goodbye. It had to do with material prosperity. Is it shalom with you today, men? Do you have enough money? If we went camping and I ask, is the tent shalom? It meant, is it secure? When Joseph came to Egypt, or when the brothers of Joseph came to Egypt, he said, is our father shalom? What do you think he meant? What do you think the RSV says for that word? Translates it in English. Is our father shalom? Well. And that meant physically, and how's he doing, and what's his attitude? Okay, it was that kind of inclusive, total well-being, wholeness kind of thing. But as it's used in all those Old Testament ways, and Kittle summarizes, I think there are some basic themes. One is it's always a covenantal word. It's part of God's promise. It's a gift. It was part of... It was a bequest. It was the fact that he had called this people to be his people, and the covenant of my shalom shall not depart from thee, Isaiah says, or God says through Isaiah. Secondly, it's always an interconnected kind of word. The totality of well-being includes our relationship not only with one another but with the created world. It had the picture of an ecosystem or you can never do merely one thing, Garrett Hardin said. That's a shalom idea, that there is a delicate web of interdependencies. All right. And the final thing, and this is where Kittle, who did the word study, says this is the heart, this is the key, it's a justice word. It is never an individual kind of peace, and it's never an inward kind of peace. It's a social concept. All right. Those are the things that I tried to outline yesterday. And I think that the concept of shalom is the kind of vision or biblical way of seeing that really gives some clues to the things that make for peace. I mean, I think that it's a rich word, and that it helps us see in a different kind of way. The shalom conferences and the theme that both Daily Vacation Bible School and Women of the Church and some of the curriculum have had in the last couple of years, I think, have opened it up newly for, or in a new way for us. But that's the kind of understanding that things that make for peace. I think Jesus had that shalom idea when he said that over the city of Jerusalem. Would that even today you knew that concept again and knew what made for a shalom community. Other comments or questions? Yes.
It seems like in relationship to the shalom community idea too, that a theology of enough has to focus on the other, on the neighbor, in for the health of my participation in it.
For the what?
Well, for my own health in doing it, because what my primary purpose is, a lifestyle change, is my survival or the extension of myself, whether it's my children or whatever, my style, and some important things, economically. It seems like there's a real possibility either of self-righteousness or just that survival instinct, reading worse things
right
in another form. And it seems like when you say it has to be gospel, it takes the gospel maybe proclaimed in some arenas that we're not used to having to deal with it. We may, as Christians, talk about our lifestyles and ramifications for other people, but that even the focus of our changing, that we have to be reminded when you bring in this biblical world view, you know, and how we can be even shaped now by, in the Old Testament, concern for the world. We are sophisticated beyond that need. That we need to be reminded why we do it. It's like one of the things that in reading about prayer this month that struck me was how you don't, it's not even, I think with Brother Lawrence, it's not for the pleasure of God's company that you are in prayer, although that may be a given, but that he requests that. That the demand, in a sense, is upon us, the invitation is one that we really can't refuse to accept after a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's under a command and obedience that we change And it isn't because we've suddenly gotten so smart and we're so, but that we have been outside of that range of obedience for a long time. That's not my, well, now I've got some terrific insights that you don't have, buddy, and I'm going to prove now how, in another sense, I'm really better than you because I'm poorer than you are, or I'm managing. Just seems like the knowing myself anyway, how something that seems clear and good, I can really paint with my own reason.
That's very helpful. I guess one of the things that's very frustrating is to be invited to do one evening on simplicity or simple life and not have the chance to set in the kind of context that we have here. And the best that you can do in that case is something like a list of by Jorgen Listener that says at the beginning there are some wrong reasons for lifestyle changes. It can be done so that you feel morally pure. It can be an escape from justice issue. To say there can be some wrong reasons for doing it, but it's much better to be able to have it in the context of a biblical view, of a theology of enough, of global justice coming on Friday or Saturday, and a look at world hunger, because it is in that context, or else it can really be both a cop-out and a kind of a new way of turning inward or taking care of myself. Some of the simple life stuff is to make sure you're okay if catastrophe comes. I mean, enough food for your family and that kind of thing, which is far from a biblical concept of shalom. Yeah, go ahead, Elise.
Well, the thing is, like, move from despair to despair, if you do it in a certain sense. And if we're renewed in the covenant, which Christ reveals to us in our relationship with God the Father, who is the Creator, then even if we can't read the signs as being hopeful, we don't have to be Pollyannish and say it's not happening, but we do have a sense of a command.
Right.
It sounds terrible if you know the terrific terms in the framework, but you know, that sense of obedience is so difficult for me to grasp, and that covers a knowledge to them that's much greater than mine. And I don't have to get into arguments of, well, that the economics of despair or whatever, how are you going to help the race for that? And just commit suicide, do abortion, I mean, get rid of people, that's the problem. Start with me, you know, and stuff on and on. I mean, you can take that in a science fiction line too, but I think that there's such a hope, and I'm really glad for these references that you brought in, because I think that it's one of the hardest situations to do with hope. And it's impossible if we're looking at the God that we understand through Scripture to be taking care of this world through Him. Then there isn't any other way except hope. And even if this whole world blows up or burns up like this scientist says, that's not the final word. So I don't want to be a cause for blowing it up, but I can hardly help myself being a cause. I'm tainted in the other way. But I don't have to continue to contribute to what I, you know, it's like ignorance is bliss. So.
When we were at Holden last time, I know I spent some time with Jacques Ellul's book, Violence, and at least Larry Collins got turned on by that, sent me a whole series of slides and presentation that he does summarizing that book. It's just beautifully done. Jacques Ellul has a more recent book called Hope in an Age of Abandonment. And if you want to read a really hopeful book, in his preface he said that for some 20 years, he's basically a sociologist. His primary work would be something like the Technological Society. He's a layman, but a very good theologian. For over 20 years, he was accumulating the documentation for this being an age of abandonment, even scripturally speaking, the kind of thing that Bergman does by a film that says, how do you live in the silences of God? I mean, Ellul agrees with that kind of analysis, maybe, for our age. And said, and I had also written books about hope. But it was only when I really delved into this being an age of abandonment did I write a book in hope. Because hope, biblically, comes alive only in an age of abandonment. I mean, there are some other times when you urge people to believe But an age of abandonment is when you find that alive biblical concept of hoping. And it's a beautiful book. It just comes off as very real, that it came right out of his gut. So if you need a book to be hopeful, it's not Pollyanna. It is an age of abandonment, but it's a very biblical way of seeing it as hope. Yeah, John?
Something behind, I think, Elise is saying, too, is that to separate, say, a lifestyle of shalom from effectiveness. I mean, achieving an end that we might see as politically advantageous. I mean, what I have to do, I have to do.
Yeah.
As obedience to God. And whether or not it works or not. And yeah. I think that the conversation, you know, about these kinds of subjects can many times bog down on those points where you say it's not effective. It's not mm-hmm. effective. Well, that may be. We have apocalyptic stories in the New Testament tell us how things are going to end and how effective we may be. But the call is there to live a certain way no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that I have to keep reminding myself, because I can get into low enough economics, political science, and so forth, to see some real problems, like, for instance, the Old Testament land is it as big as the Wenatchee Valley forest that they were talking about, to work within this kind of bound and global vision is, there's a real question of mm-hmm. how much we can do, but the call seems, no matter how effective it is, no matter how well we can do it, we live a certain way. And that one thing that Al Pitcher was so excited about, in a sense, talking about Al Heilbronner and some of the forecasts that he had, was that, now is the time where we may see that we have to do what we should have done to our health
mm-hmm.
200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
it's not that what's so much what's right now is just right now. What's right now is what was right now. And that's I think knowing that saves the shalom from being tangled, brambled to death by practical argument.
Yeah, I imagine all of you are somewhat eager to get to more practical things like tomorrow, and I understand that. I'm glad for your kind of hanging in there for 2 days of background or theology. Let me say it one more time. Seems to me in the early Christian church that very, very early the fatal mistake was made when people saw what that group of Christians, that little band, had. It was obviously attractive, and people said, how do I get it? And the wrong answer came very quickly. The wrong answer is, you do what they do and you'll have it. What they had was a new way of seeing. They had a new reality. In Clarence Jordan's terms, they got ready, they changed their whole way of thinking, for a new order of the Spirit is impinging upon you, and it did. And they expressed that in some kind of lifestyle. And it included going to church and giving generously of their money and saying their prayers and meeting together in homes and breaking bread. And okay, as soon as the answer came, you'll have what they have if you do what they do, then people went to church, gave 10%, said their prayers, and lo and behold, it didn't necessarily lead to that experience. It instead of seeing the way they saw or having that new spirit impinge upon them, they tried to do the outward things in order to have it. It seems to me that the same thing can be true today, that the wrong reasons for simple living might be that instead of asking, why is there a new way of seeing, or why is that a new freedom? You ask, what is simple life? And the answer comes back, it's soybeans instead of beef, and it's jeans instead of double knits, or a lot of other things. And then often it's just depriving yourself, and then suddenly it's not very freeing, and it never had that new way of seeing. In a theological perspective, in a biblical consciousness. Otherwise, I think it can be too shallow or not have that kind of new consciousness behind it. So we will get to the practical, and Mary is better looking and easier to look at than me, so everything is up for tomorrow. But I thank you for hanging in there for a couple days and encourage you to keep trying to get that biblical consciousness, which is really the revolution, which is really the conversion. Okay.